This podcast is supported by the Icon School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, one of America's leading medical research schools. How will advances in artificial intelligence transform medical research and medical care? To find out, we invite you to read a special supplement to Science Magazine prepared by Icon Mount Sinai in partnership with Science. Just visit our website at science.org and search for Frontiers of Medical Research-Artificial Intelligence. On May 1st and May 2nd, Icon Mount Sinai and the New York Academy of Sciences will be convening a major symposium in New York City on the new wave of AI in healthcare. For more information and to register, please visit events.nyas.org/AI Health. That's events.nyas.org/AI Health. The Icon School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. We find a way. This week's episode is brought to you in part by the Eppendorf and Science Prize for Neurobiology. Are you or one of your colleagues doing great neuroscience? If so, then we encourage you to apply for the prestigious Eppendorf and Science Prize for Neurobiology, an international prize which honors young scientists for outstanding neurobiological research based on methods of molecular, cellular, systems, or organismic biology. Submissions are due June 15th. Visit science.org/Eppendorf to apply today. This is the Science Podcast for December 23rd, 2022. I'm Sarah Crespi. We've got a great show coming up. It's actually our last show of the year. But before we get to it, one reminder, please, if you haven't already, take our podcast survey. It's short. There's a chance for a prize. We really want to hear from you. Just go to the link, science.org/podcast, click on the pop-up. This is our last show of the year. We're not going to have one next week. This one is double fun. David Grimm, our online news editor, is here to give us a tour of the top online stories for the year, from playful bumblebees to parasite-ridden friars. And we're going to have highlights of some of the most interesting things to happen on the podcast this year. We'll learn about why we aren't just shooting nuclear waste into the sun, and how mapping ant diversity is like mapping the universe. Now we have online news editor David Grimm. He's here with the top online stories from 2022. Hi, Dave.
Hey, Sarah.
So I'm going to start with the obvious question anyone would have looking at this list. Where are all the animal stories, Dave?
Yeah, well, you know, this is a weird year for us. We usually have at least one cute animal story, usually a cat or a dog story. This year is an exception, although we do have a cute insect story.
That's right. It is the cutest of the insects, I would say. So what does this mean? Like, is our audience no longer interested in animal stories? Is this list based on current trends in internet usage? Like, how do you come up with this list? And what's your theory on the disappearance of animals?
Well, you know, our top 10 list isn't usually, actually it never is the biggest scientific achievements of the year. We leave that to the breakthrough folks. But it's sort of a mix of our kind of staff favorites and our most reader popular stories. And you're right, usually that does include a cute, fuzzy animal story, but readers seem to be gravitating towards other content this year. So we have a sort of a different mix of stories this time around.
Okay. Well, let's start with the, as you say, the cute insect story. This one is by staff writer Eric Stockstead. It's about bumblebees playing with toys. Okay, how does this come up? Why would someone ask this question?
Well, as you might imagine, Sarah, this one happened by accident. Researchers were studying just how bumblebees learn. And as part of the experiment, they had given them these sort of small wooden balls. And lo and behold, when the bees were left alone with the balls, they seemed to be playing with them. They seemed to be rolling them around. They had plenty of other stuff they could have been doing. So they seemed to be sort of unusually attracted to the balls. Some of them rolled the balls 44 times a day. So it seemed to be an activity that they were really hooked on for some reason.
Mm-hmm. And this was a really elaborate setup. You know, they gave the bees the option. You can walk through this space. You can go play with the balls. You can walk around the balls that are set down, like glued down, on your way to the kitchen to eat food. So they really did have a choice here. And many of them chose to go play with the balls that are about the same size as the bee. So it's like a very strange, like, you should see the video of this.
Right. There's a cool video. And yeah, you know, once they sort of suspected that the bees might be playing, they set up what they call this kind of mini apartment complex for the bees, where there was sort of a food room and a recreation room. And this was the room with the balls. And actually, the bees kind of had to, the way this apartment was set up, the bees actually kind of had to work to get to the ballroom. So it wasn't just a case of like they would happen upon the balls. They really had to like try to get there. And that's what the team found, that the bees really seemed to gravitate towards this room with the balls. And then once they got there, they again seemed to start playing with these objects.
So do we know that this is play, that they're having fun versus, you know, doing something instinctual? This reminds them of some other task that they feel like they have to do.
Well, you know, that's the open question. We can't get inside the bee's mind. You know, some outside experts do believe that this is a very convincing example of play, but others say, you know, this seems to remind them of housekeeping behavior that bees do when they remove dead bees and other debris from their nests. And so they would like to see more evidence that this is actually play.
Mm-hmm. So what would it mean if a bumblebee was capable of playing and having fun, even in a research setting?
This sort of reminds me of a story that may have made one of our top 10 lists several years ago, which is a scientist had put a exercise wheel, like, you know, a hamster running wheel.
Oh, this is my favorite.
Yeah. In their backyard or something. Yeah. It's been a few years, but they found that, and they put a video on it, that animals would just sort of emerge out of the forest and start running on this wheel for no reason.
Not just rodents, right? Frogs. There's a slug on the wheel. It's amazing.
It was crazy. And so, you know, this seems to be more part and parcel of that, you know, like if we give animals the opportunity to play, they are going to play. So I think it's just another fun example of the mysteries of nature and the playful nature of a lot of the animals around us.
Yeah, I thought we were going to end up on consciousness, and I had this really nice segue into the next story that we're going to do, which is about AIs. And it's kind of hard not to do a story about AI these days. And this is about whether or not an AI can listen in on your conversation and how to maybe prevent that with another AI. This is a story by freelancer Matt Hudson. So is this really a scientific problem, Dave?
I guess it's more of a privacy problem, but it's also actually a scientific problem, as I think we'll get into. And I love the story too, Sarah, because it's like, is AI good? Is AI bad? And this is sort of sidesteps the question a little bit and says, well, regardless of whether it's good or bad, we can use AI to fight other AI. Who doesn't love AI fighting other AI?
True.
So I guess it starts with what some would consider bad AI. And this is people using things like Bossware or to spy on employees, or even sort of
Bossware?
Yeah, it's called Bossware. It's sort of, you know, it can be installed on computers and supervisors can sort of listen in on what their employees are doing. But there's less sort of insidious, or what some people might consider less insidious examples of this. You've got the Alexa voice assistant in your home. You've got Siri. We've got devices all around us that are basically listening to us all the time. And the question is, you know, if we don't want them listening to us, or if we don't want them to be able to sort of interpret what we're saying, is there a way to prevent that from happening?
That's where this other AI for the good in this very limited case comes in.
Right. This is a new technology called neural voice camouflage. And it's sort of this interesting idea where if something is listening to you and then transcribing that as text, can you combat that with an AI that sort of creates nonsense noise in the background that will confuse the listening AI so that what it translates ends up just being garbled?
Hmm. We have a sample here. Let's play the audio of a person talking with this AI-generated audio camouflage behind it.
Now then, let's enter the city and enjoy the great feast that's being cooked. I'm nearly starving myself, but this conquering kingdoms is hard work.
What's cool about that clip, Sarah, is you can actually hear what the person is saying. You and I could have a conversation. It's not like the AI is creating so much noise that we can't understand what each other is saying. For the AI listening in, that background noise that we kind of barely hear, it sounds a little bit like static to us, actually is sort of garbling everything we're saying.
So if you look at the transcript that the AI makes of it, it's not accurate. It's actually pretty difficult to read.
Exactly.
Here's my question. The smokescreen AI, the one creating a camouflage, is that listening to you?
I guess it kind of is. Well, it's listening, but it's also sort of predicting. That's one of the really cool advances of this technology because, you know, for an AI to be able to sort of camouflage what you're saying, it needs to be able to predict what you're going to say. Otherwise, it can't do this in real time, and therefore, the technology would be useless. And so what's kind of cool about this technology is it actually kind of predicts, based on the first few words you say, what the next few words you might say are. So for example, if you're going to say, enjoy the great feast, the AI may predict that the next few words you're going to say are, that's being cooked. And by making that prediction, it creates the camouflage that prevents another AI from listening basically to the rest of that sentence.
Oh my goodness.
And what's cool about that technology is it sort of extends beyond this particular application of privacy. You can imagine, you know, when it comes to self-driving cars or other technology where a computer needs to predict what we're going to do next or what might happen next. Is a pedestrian going to jump in the middle of the road? This is an important step on that pathway as well.
Okay, but last question, only semi-jokey. Will the other AIs learn how to beat the camouflage AIs?
I'm sure they will.
All right.
Sorry to end on a down note there, Sarah, but...
That's okay.
Can never keep a good AI down.
The last story we're going to talk about, and we'll tease some of the other ones. And this one is technically about animals, but not in the, that's a cute animal story, that's a, you know, a domestication story. It's about parasites in people. And for this, we're going to go back in time to medieval times. Where are we, Dave? And what's with all these open graves?
So we are in Cambridge, circa about 13th or 14th century of the Common Era. And we are dealing with medieval friars. And these are groups of men that lived secluded from the rest of the town, with their own dwellings and actually their own sanitary system. So I like this story because it's kind of gross. It's probably one of our grossest stories of the year. We always try to get one of those in the lineup. And what's interesting about these friars is the townspeople didn't live a very sanitary existence. They all sort of lived in cramped cottages and they dumped all of their, let's say, household excrement.
And they lived with their domesticated animals. They just brought everybody in, right?
Right. And they're dumping all this excrement into communal holes in the ground called cesspits. And so if you've heard the word cesspit, that's where it comes from. And so probably not the most pleasing environment, sanitary environment, nice smelling environment. Now, the friars weren't exactly living a sterile lifestyle, but their lifestyle was more sanitary because their latrines were isolated. And so they had separate places to put their excrement that weren't as close to their living conditions. Some of them even had running water. And so while we would probably judge their lifestyle still pretty dirty by today's standards, compared to the townsfolk that they lived near, their living conditions were actually pretty sanitary.
Okay, here comes the twist. Who has the most parasites?
Well, right, this is the medieval riddle here, because these friars were riddled. Do you get that?
Oh, no.
Riddled with parasites. You see what I did there, Sarah?
I did.
So they were riddled with parasites. That's what this new study found. So a team of researchers uncovered the skeletons of several of these friars. And when they analyzed the dirt around their pelvises, they found the eggs, or the eggs of parasitic worms that would have wreaked havoc in the intestines of these friars, causing a lot of abdominal discomfort and other GI issues likely.
There's dirt. It's around a body. You know, how do we know that that was like part of the body and not just parasite worm eggs in some soil?
Right. So they compared the soil to soil that was near the friars' feet and other parts of the body. And they're really only finding the worms where the friars' intestines would have been.
And the townspeople.
Right. And the townspeople didn't have nearly as many, which is really interesting. Because again, if the friars were sort of so relatively sanitary, why do they have so many more parasites? In fact, they were twice as likely to be infected with these parasites than the townsfolk.
Okay. So tell me, what was the townsfolk's secret to parasite-free living?
Well, it may be the opposite. In fact, in that it was the friars that were doing much more to expose themselves to these parasites. It turns out it may have to do with their gardening, because when they would garden, they would remove, because their sort of excrement was so nicely stored, they were able to sort of access it very easily as well. And the thought is that they were using it to fertilize their gardens, their vegetable gardens. And of course, if there's parasites in the excrement, that parasite's getting into the garden, it's getting into the food they eat the parasites. They are pooping the parasites out again, and then putting it back in the garden.
Round two.
Right. And so this isn't proven, but this is the speculation that they were basically kind of recycling these parasites through their bodies and through their garden over potentially a long amount of time.
On that note, Dave, Let's talk about some of the other top online stories, and then I'll let you go. Is there anyone in particular that you want to direct people's attention to?
Well, I'll just briefly mention a couple other ones. We have a really fun story about how weather can influence baby names and how a couple of names may be about to blow up. The fastest human migration in ancient history, and also our top story of the year, which is also one of our most popular stories of the year. You're going to have to go to the site to figure out that one and a few of the other stories that we didn't mention here.
All right. Thank you so much, Dave. Great to have you as always.
Thanks, Sarah.
David Grimm is the online news editor for Science. You can find a link to the top online stories from this year at science.org/podcast. Stay tuned for a roundup of some of our top podcast highlights and hear how our expert guests feel about sci-fi books and movies that touch on their areas of expertise. This week's episode is brought to you in part by Science Careers. Change your job and you might just change the world. For anyone who's looking to get ahead in or just plain get into science, there's no better, more trusted resource than Science Careers. And it's free. On our site, you can search career opportunities across all disciplines and levels, research potential employers, sign up to get job alerts via email, upload your resume or CV to the searchable database, or read career advice articles. There's no shortage of global problems today that science can't solve. Be part of the solution. Visit sciencecareers.org today. At the end of the year, I have to admit, after interviewing close to 100 researchers and science writers, I'm going to forget some of the stuff I learned that year. It's hard to keep planetary science and epidemiology straight after just so many conversations. But I do have some interviews, some questions that stick out in my mind. So what follows are some of my favorite bits of audio from the show. Yes, there are other memorable things that happened, for sure, but these really stick out and, you know, they run the gamut from inspiring to ridiculous. I mean, yeah, sometimes I ask a bad question. I do think there's one in here that I'm sharing. First, though, let's start with a question I never thought I would be asking. This is from an interview with Ashley Thomas. Her work looks at how babies share saliva. Turns out, they tend to only do that with their closest relatives. Think about it like this. Who would you share a straw with? Never the stranger on the subway. Only someone you're close to, right? But I thought, maybe there's a few different kinds of spit sharing that don't fit into these categories. What about spitting in a mean way?
Obviously, in the wrong context, or if you force someone to sort of take your saliva when they don't want it, saliva sharing can be really bad. And it can, in fact, be a signal that you really don't like something or someone. And so one question is like whether these two inferences about saliva are related. So is it the case that spitting on someone is really bad because in other contexts, it's actually sharing saliva is actually a positive thing if you're in a close relationship.
We make a lot of strange connections on the podcast. I think one of the best for the year was actually this metaphor from Evan Economo. He published a paper that attempted to map the biodiversity of ants across different parts of the world. But as you'll see from his comments, there's still a lot to learn.
I sort of talk about it like it's in astronomy, we have these wonderful images from the Webb telescope. In every round of astronomy, we go up and we take pictures and we see things, but there's more questions and there's some things that are not resolvable. And then we improve it over time and we get a better and better view. And so I think of it like this. This is sort of the first time we took a picture of some big galaxy and it's not perfect. It doesn't have all the information. There may be problems with it, but we can start iterating and improving it, both for ants and for other groups.
Another amazing connection that came up in the show was made for me by Hannah Carey. She published a paper on the role of a certain type of bacteria in helping squirrels hibernate or enter the state called torpor. And the bacteria help the squirrels not run out of the precious nutrients they need to stay alive and be able to start their engines again in the spring. So we spent a lot of time during the interview talking about the chemical processes involved, temperatures, bacteria, whatnot. The next thing I know, we're talking about space.
The first author of this paper, Matthew Regan, as a young child, he's been fascinated with space travel. And the studies that he'll be continuing along these lines includes asking whether enhancing the symbiosis between gut microbes and their human hosts could be manipulated to enhance their ability to recoup their urea nitrogen during long distance, long duration space travel, like in deep space, where you just can't put enough food on these spacecraft, right?
We'd have onboard recyclers.
Humans and their buddies, their gut microbes. It's a symbiosis for sure.
Yeah. I thought you were going to say, you know, human hibernation, like if we could induce hibernation in humans.
That's part of the equation too. Both European Space Agency and NASA are interested in this idea about inducing a safe and reversible metabolic depression, a torpor-like state. Nothing as extreme as the little ground squirrels do, but something more akin to bears. Actually, bears would be a good model because of their body size. The other benefit is there are studies supported by NASA in the 50s and 60s that suggest the torpor state protects against radiation damage. So there may be a double benefit there.
Speaking of sending things into space. Okay. So I had this conversation with Sadir Elshok. He's a freelancer who wrote a story this year about a project in Finland to put radioactive waste from nuclear power plants deep, deep underground. The project's wrapping up, and it's kind of an engineering marvel story crossed with, you know, getting a look at how a country can get it together enough to decide what to do with this kind of waste and get the public on board. But I had a burning question for Sadir. Okay, so Sadir, why are we not just shooting it all into the sun?
That's a good question. I think...
No, it's not, is it?
Well, I mean, it's a good question in the sense that, like, what's wrong with shooting it into the sun? I think it's probably quite difficult and quite unsafe, just the process of getting it to the sun.
Oh, that's a good point.
And then from a kind of moral responsibility question, I don't know that slinging our waste at the sun and being sure that we didn't miscalculate is necessarily the right thing to do.
I see your point. Yeah. Another question I never thought I'd ask. I was talking with Katie Hampson, who has spent decades studying the rabies virus in dogs. And she published a paper on contact tracing rabies in a population of like 50,000 dogs. In our discussion, she mentioned that, you know, there's a lot of variability in what happens to the dogs when they're infected with rabies. Some of them at the extreme end will bite up to 50 other dogs. Others will travel kilometers to other villages to seed a new outbreak. All of these behaviors really made me wonder.
I can't help wanting to ask, is rabies doing this on purpose? Is it making dogs travel long distances, making dogs bite lots of dogs? Like, I don't even know how to ask that question. I keep thinking about that infection that happens in insects that makes them climb to the top of trees.
Oh, yeah, the ants that climb to the top.
Yeah.
So it's a well-honed virus. My personal opinion is that it is doing this effectively on purpose. Back in the day, people did do cross-infection experiments, and the viruses that were basically inoculated into dogs were much more transmissible to other dogs rather than raccoons or mice or bats or something. We know the virus is adapted to its host to spread better in its particular host, and it relates to the body size of the animal and the viral dose and so on. But it is kind of a fascinating virus, and I'm sure that the reason it's like this is because it's effective to do so.
Okay, this next one I have to include because, you know, even though we should never experiment on ourselves, sometimes it comes up in conversation. Jordi Vujkovic was seeing this harm from sunscreen to corals. And actually, it was a byproduct of the sunscreen. The animal breaks it down, and then it's exposed to sunlight, and it's bad for them. It's phototoxic. So I asked him, is this a problem for us too? Does the human body make these same potentially toxic byproducts?
I found this out from personal experience.
No.
I was actually curious, and exactly what you're asking me now is basically, what do we know about this? And while we did know that we're forming this metabolite, we actually didn't know anything about this metabolite's phototoxicity, whether it is or isn't. So when I found this in corals, I was also curious what is happening with our metabolite. I ended up one night just putting a lot of sunscreen on myself and then the next day measuring it in my urine, taking some samples, purifying it. And it turned out that this new molecule that I isolated ended up being a phototoxin as well.
But you're not see-through, so maybe it's not as harmful for us.
That's a very important point, yes. So it's a question of where exactly this compound is formed. If it's at the very surface of the skin, then maybe it could have an effect. If it's formed in the liver, like a lot of these metabolic products are in humans, then maybe not.
One of the really great things about getting to interview so many people every year is that I get to know our reporters really well because they're writing, I'm talking to them about their stories. And so then I kind of have insight into how some of these stories come about. For example, Kai Kupferschmidt, who we really usually hear from on epidemiology. He covered COVID, he covered monkeypox. You know, this is something he's really dedicated to. But I also happen to know he wrote a book on the color blue. So when for some reason he was writing a feature story on an endangered animal, the Styx macaw, I just had to ask. What drew your attention to this bird in the first place? Is it because you wrote a book about the color blue and the Styx macaw is a bluebird?
Yeah, you got me, of course. I mean, people who know me know that I love the color blue and that I'm fascinated by it. And like you say, I wrote this book about the color blue in nature and why it's rare. I think that's one of the things about the Styx macaw that probably also led to its extinction is the fact that the bird is rare and it's probably very coveted because of this rare color. When I wrote the book, I wanted to show, on the one hand, that we're losing these amazing colors from nature, you know, all of these hues that are there because we're destroying animals' habitats and we're poaching them to extinction. But then I didn't want the end to be so depressing. And the Styx macaw had this positive spin in a way because breeders and conservationists have managed to breed it in captivity. And there has been this plan for a long time now to release some captive birds into the wild, hoping that they will then build up a new flock of Styx macaws in the wild.
We're going to wrap up here with what I've been calling the while I have you questions. This is something we've been doing for a few months. I've been asking many of the guests on the show, while I have you, let me ask you a kind of a random question. And we're starting simply. They're all researchers, scientists, science writers. So I asked if they enjoy sci-fi, books, or movies, and if so, which ones? You might even have heard a few of these. At the very ends of our interviews, I asked them, and then also I want to know, does the sci-fi that they enjoy relate to the type of science that they do? I like sci-fi. I really enjoy it, but I don't have a field. I just, you know, try to cover it all these days. But Kazuhara Arakawa, he wrote a paper comparing the properties of silks made by many different types of spiders. And he's also looked at the different materials made by tardigrades. You know, these are the kinds of things that help them be the indestructible little creatures that they are, help them survive being frozen, being dried out, that kind of thing. Well, here's what Kazu had to say about sci-fi.
You study genetics, biology, so much stuff. Do you read science fiction about these topics?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Oh,
a
you
lot.
Do?
Yes.
What do you like? What do you like that relates to what you actually studied? Have you found any books that you...
You know the novel called Three Bodies? Mm. It's a Chinese novel. It was Chinese science fiction, which was quite big 2-3 years ago.
Oh, I'll have to check it out.
It's about the remote, I mean, imaginary remote planet, which dries up in seasons. And so the humanoids living in that planet has accustomed to the planet so that they can dry up. But they can rehydrate.
This is so tardigrades. Similar to your tardigrades.
Yes.
That's so
yeah,
great.
So it was really exciting.
Even when our guests couldn't think of a closely related book or movie that they enjoyed, talking about sci-fi sometimes sparked more insights into the work that we were discussing. This was the case with Herman Ponzer, who had just spent about 30 minutes describing to me how to monitor how much water people take in and how much they excrete, something that's really never been carefully measured before.
Yeah. Do you watch the movies?
Some. Not tons. I mean, like, it depends on what level, you know?
Yeah. I mean, this is a real Dune type situation here where we're like...
Yeah. I mean, that's the obvious connection. And I did watch Dune.
I mean, that was the one thing I was wondering, though, is why wouldn't we have figured this out for astronauts?
Oh, but see, here's the thing. If you're an astronaut, first of all, they recycle all their water. So as long as there's enough up there... Who cares?
Like, you get what you get when you're up there.
That's right. That's right. And because, you know, that's actually a really great example. So this is a closed system. The amount of water that you lose has to be equal to the water that you gain. And as long as you keep that system closed, as long as you close the loop on that, if you go up with basically enough, you're fine forever.
Yeah. So we don't need to know how much you need to go to space.
We just have to get it right enough.
I did run into a few reporters, science writers that were creating science fiction on their own time. But one researcher I spoke with was actually the inspiration for his husband's work. This is Kaito Kikuchi. His research involves discovering how spores, and these are the way bacteria protect themselves during times of trouble. They go into spore form and that can lie dormant for thousands of years. And then at some point, these spores, even though they're dormant and very inactive, they're able to detect their environment and say, oh, it's a good time to wake up. So I asked Kaito about his preferences in sci-fi. Do you have any favorite science fiction books that touch on your like domain of science?
That's a good question. Like microbiology. I don't really have any that come up to mind. It's funny because my husband's a novelist and he's trying to write a fantasy
really
novel. He wrote a novel that uses spores as magic system.
Oh.
He's trying to find a publisher.
That's so cool. I love it.
But yeah, whenever that comes out, I'll ping you.
So what sci-fi do you like that you've read?
Yeah, I really like N.K. Jemisin's Broken World series. It was super nice.
For the geologists out there.
Yep, yep. So I guess they got that one.
They did get that one.
Recently, I've been reading a more lighthearted novella called The Murderbot Diaries.
Oh, I love that. So good.
Yeah, so I think I really like that one too.
I really like that. I talked to a few roboticists and it's so fun. It's such an interesting field and we're never going to get close to that in reality. But
yeah, we never get a genderless sassy robot.
Unfortunately, no. Yeah, although maybe that's what R2 was.
Maybe so. He was pretty sassy.
Okay, that's it. We're wrapping up 2022. We'll see you again in the new year. I hope you enjoyed listening back to some of the highlights of this podcast for the year. I truly enjoy every interview I do, and it's so great to be able to talk to all these people and share your love of science and now sci-fi. And that concludes this edition of the Science Podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions, write to us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. Or better yet, take our audience survey at science.org/podcast. There's a pop-up. Click on it, answer a few questions. Maybe you'll win a prize. That's science.org/podcast. You can also listen to this show on the Science website at science.org/podcast. Or search for Science Magazine on any podcasting app. This show was edited and produced by me, Sarah Crespi, with production help from Podigy, Kevin McLean, and Megan Cantwell. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. On behalf of Science and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us. This week's episode is brought to you in part by Science Careers. Looking for some career advice? Wondering how to get ahead or how to strike a better work-life balance? Visit our site to read how others are doing it. Use our individual development plan tool, access topic-specific article collections, or search for an exciting new job. Science Careers, produced by Science and AAAS, is a free website full of resources to help get the most out of your career. Visit sciencecareers.org today to get started.